is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Multiple inquiries, lots of pressure and a Four Corners report shortly after the head of one of the major supermarkets in Australia says he's leaving. We'll talk about why and we'll talk about the further pressure being placed on supermarkets in Australia today on the Country Hour. If you have a view, you can always send us a text 0467 842 722. You can call as well 1300 977 222. Plus, cattle producers, in what might be good news for you, we have one analyst on the program today saying the 2023 low prices in beef cattle is probably the lowest you're going to get for the rest of the decade. Yes, he'll put his neck on the line and tell you why that is today on the program. And an extended interview. Look, yesterday was all about the argy-bargy of the internal politics of the VFF. We're getting away about internal politics today. We're having an extended interview on one of the fathers, really, of Australia's modern agricultural movement and really one of the fathers of Australian agricultural research and its gift to the world. Sir John Crawford, a book on his legacy, has been, released today in Canberra at the National Press Club. Whilst that's going on, you'll be able to hear from the historian involved in that project today on the Country. A special extended interview. You're going to learn a whole lot more, not only about the history of Australian agriculture and what we've done for the world, but also the legacy of the man who drove most of it and what it means for what we can do today. That coming up for the Country Hour today. Up next, though, let's talk supermarkets.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
As Australia looks more closely at the actions of major supermarkets than ever before, one of the heads of the two major supermarkets is leaving. Brad Banducci has been the CEO of Woolworths for nearly 9 years and is going at a time that supermarkets are being looked at closely. As I said, six major inquiries currently ongoing looking at the actions of supermarkets, a Four Corners report, and a lot of pressure being put on how much you're being charged for your groceries, how much of a difference there is between what farmers are being paid and what consumers are paying, and what it means for the corporate culture in Australia as well. One of the leaders of the calls for more pressure being put on supermarkets and a greater look at their actions in the Australian marketplace is the leader of the National Party, David Littleproud, who can join you on the program now and talk about this latest development. David Littleproud, welcome back to the Country.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brad Banducci leaving Woolworths. What do you make of the timing of this? Woolworths says it has nothing to do with the recent pressure or the Four Corners report. What do you make of it?
Well, it's an admission of guilt, not just from Woolworths, but by extension, an admission of guilt for Coles as well. And all that Brad Banducci will leave is a legacy of destruction at the farm gate and now for consumers as well. He has resided not only over what he did to the dairy industry, but what he did to the horticulture industry and what he's been doing to the wine as well as the red meat sector. The evidence has been plain to see. When we were in government, we put in place an ACCC inquiry into perishable goods. I don't think the recommendations that came back from the ACCC went far enough. And while we implemented nearly all of them but ran out of time before the election, it's evidence now we need to do more. And I think it's beholden on this government not to keep reviewing this and kicking this down the road. It's time for punitive penalties when these supermarkets control so much of the marketplace that we need to have regulatory guide rails, but penalties that the ACCC can use that should scale up to divestiture powers that would see the removal of some of their shops they'd have to sell in a geographical area or selling off one of their chains like Big W or BWS. Their behaviour is plain to see.
So you think government should go that far as to tell a business where it can and can't do business?
We've already got big stick legislation with the energy sector, and most countries around the world already have divestiture powers in place. They're used as a last resort and used where there is market concentration and too much market power. Now, when these two, as well as the big German, control 74% of the market, they are the market. And when you're dealing in a perishable commodity where farmers are held over the barrow, but you're dealing in a commodity that underpins all life. I'm not against them making profits. It's just how they make those profits that needs to make sure there's regulatory guide rails. And when you think about that concentration of 74%, the big three in the United States only have 34% of the market because there's more competition.
How do the free marketeers of the Liberal Party feel about you wanting to use these powers on supermarkets?
Well, that's up to them. I'm the leader of the National Party. I believe we represent those people, that 30% of Australians that live outside the capital city, the men and women that go out there and are producing our food and fibre. And I've had a passionate hate for these supermarkets for some time since I became the Agriculture Minister. I tried to do what I could in terms of those inquiries. We got some change, but I think we've been too timid, not just as a coalition, but as governments. And I think Alan Fels reinforced that it continues to show that there is greater powers required. His review that came back only 3 weeks ago reinforced what the Nationals have been saying, is greater powers to the ACCC to have a more agile ACCC that can do the investigations when the evidence is clear, to get in there, and but then to have the penalties. He's actually calling for divestiture powers now too. I mean, for a former ACCC chair to agree with the National Party and say we're now to that juncture, I think the signs are there that it's beholden on legislators for protection, not just of farmers, but of consumers, because there is too much market power given to these corporates.
Can I just use some of your words that you were just speaking to put a full stop on that? You just said you had a passionate hate for the actions of some of these supermarkets. So did you have any relationship at all with Brad Banducci during his time of Woolworths?
Well, it was a direct one. And in fact, one was around not only to him, but to the CEO of Coles around the dairy code of conduct and, in fact, the dollar litre milk. I made it clear to them that if they didn't walk away from dollar litre milk, there would be a Royal Commission. The National Party would walk in, and that was a week before the budget in 2019, I think it was, that the National Party would be calling for a Royal Commission into them. And funnily enough, Banducci and his Coles counterpart at the time both got rid of dollar litre milk. Now, that was demonstration that these organisations only understand the language of government making it very clear that if they don't play nice, there's consequences. And there has to be consequences when there's that much market power. Now, I'm not against them making profits. It's just how they make it. And that's why we need to get that balance right. And when Alan Fels is backing what the National Party's saying, I think this government, who we made very clear over 12 months ago, I wrote to them, I don't think we went far enough from those reviews that the ACCC sent back to us. I think we need to go further. The evidence was clear. And they've ignored me. The Albanese government just said, no, thanks. You go back, sit in your little corner. And we said we would give bipartisan support for more powers for the ACCC and bigger penalties. And we've been ignored with just six more inquiries. We don't need to review it. We just need to do it.
So it's safe to say there won't be any tears from you about the outgoing Woolworths CEO. Other people are disappointed he is leaving in a sense. David Errington is from the Bank of America. He's part of the investor presentation that Woolworths has been making on their profits today. We'll have more details on those profits later in the program. Here's his comments to Brad Banducci, though, earlier today.
I think you've been a wonderful CEO for Woolworths. I mean, when you inherited Woolworths, it was a basket case. And more importantly, what you've done is you've not only turned this business around to be back to where it normally should be as a leading supermarket business, but you've also got humility into the company. Previously, the management was very arrogant. That was on the public record. I think you even admitted that. And what you've done as a CEO is you've actually brought back humility into Woolworths, which I've really enjoyed. So I've really enjoyed you as a CEO, and you know, you've been responsive to any challenge come your way. So congratulations, and I hope your legacy goes very, very, very warmly.
Would you agree Woolworths has had humility in the business, David Littleproud?
Well, let's just look who made the comments. Of course, they are the big end of town who are investing in Woolworths, who want big returns. And I think that Brad Banducci's arrogance was on display in that Four Corners interview. And it's very ironic that now he joins Rod Sims in retirement, I would say. So, look, the legacy of Brad Banducci is clear to see, whether it be dairy, whether it be horticulture, whether it be meat, whether it be wine. He has left a trail of destruction, and Australian agriculture is the worst for it. And this is where there is time, and the evidence has become even more plain to see for everybody, particularly over the last 12 months, that it's time to do something. And we could see it, but unfortunately the fear and intimidation that these supermarkets use on farmers and suppliers meant that no one was going to come forward. But this has blown the lid on it, and it's come out for all to see And so it's beholden on us to put politics aside. And, you know, and the competition minister said last night, oh, we'd never do what the National Party's saying because effectively you'd never use the divestiture powers, only used very rarely. But that's the idea. That's the idea of having big penalties to actually prevent a course of action from companies that would think that they could cut corners to hurt people. You only want to use penalties as last resort, whether they be punitive in financial or whether they be criminal charges. That's the way that our society operates, is to have penalties there that are preventative, that creates a behaviour and a culture that is fair and equitable and is transparent. And particularly when you're dealing with such an important commodity that underpins your life, I would have thought that any government in a cost of living crisis would take anyone's hand and say, let's fix this.
Leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, is with you at the moment. Just on another issue before I let you go, David Littleproud, there is a report from a special panel looking at the options for the plan for the government to phase out live export of sheep. The government has actually had that report from their panel for around 4 months. It's not been released. The Agriculture Minister, Murray Watts, in Perth at the moment, has met with some groups representing farmers over there. I was asked in his time over there about why that report has not been released. This is what he had to say.
Well, obviously, this is a very significant decision that the government needs to make. We absolutely intend to honour the commitment that we took to the last two elections to phase out live exports of sheep by sea. But we've always said that we want to consult with people about the timeframe for that phase out and the way in which we do it. And the more that we listen to people and talk with them about how we do this, the better the outcome will be. Obviously, for a decision that's as significant as this, it's going to take quite a deal of government decision making. There's lots to consider. There's potentially budgetary implications as well that we need to consider as a government and weigh them up against other priorities. So I do understand that people are eager to see a resolution of this and for us to give them certainty, and I'm keen to do that as soon as we can.
Do you have a time frame? I think a lot of people in the industry would like that certainty.
For sure. No, look, I understand people are really keen to get a decision, and I'd like to be able to do that sooner rather than later. But equally, we need to consider this properly as a government and make sure that we come out with the right answers. But I've already committed that we will be releasing the report publicly when I make an announcement. So hopefully we will be able to make a decision and announce a decision before too long.
David Littleproud, should the government release a report sooner rather than later?
Yeah, well, in fact, Murray White promised the Western Australia Agriculture Minister that he'd release it before Christmas. He's failed to do that. And the reason, I suspect, is because there is no scientific or economic reason to do this. There never has been. We have the best animal welfare standards in the world. And what Murray White and the Labor Party and an animal activist will do is export animal welfare standards to countries like Ethiopia and Sudan. And to think that we'll walk away from industry and let those countries take it in where there will be perverse animal welfare outcomes. And it just demonstrates how morally bankrupt animal activists are. If they were really serious, and Animals Australia were really serious about this, then they'd get themselves on a Sudanese or Ethiopian boat and take a couple of photos and show the Australian public exactly what happens on those boats and compare them to the reforms that we put in place here in Australia from the boats that leave our country and the way that our sheep are treated.
However, but this also is spreading out and lengthening the period of time the government has in terms of phasing out live export, which brings me to the subject of the next election. Will the next election once again be a referendum on the future of the live export of sheep?
Well, with all due respect to the government, I don't think the people in Australia had live sheep high on their agenda as the reason they voted for the Albanese government. With all due respect, I think that is political BS. The reality is that wasn't part of the reason they voted for Anthony Albanese. But let me say, you actually have to be able to demonstrate the reasons why, the scientific and economic reasons. And this government doesn't even have the courage of its conviction to go to Katanning, as I did, and sit in front of 600-700 people and explain the science of why the Coalition and the National Party will make sure that this industry continues. And if it's phased out, we will reintroduce it. We need to give that investment confidence. There is no reason there will be perverse animal welfare outcomes, not just in the shipment, but in the processing of the sheep. We can't influence the animal welfare standards in these countries if we're not there. And this trade will continue because it's cultural and it's around food security. And to think that we are so arrogant to say Australia's going to stop and this whole thing will stop and that they'll just take our processed sheep, they won't. They'll get them from somewhere else because they don't like to be treated that way. And we have an opportunity to stay and do it right, not cut and run. That's not the Australian way. We've got the best standards, and they should be influenced everywhere around the world by giving our farmers the opportunity to export around the world.
David Littleproud, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Nationals leader David Littleproud speaking to you there. It's 12:20 here on the Country Hour. Warwick Long with you for the program again today. Let's talk about how much you're going to make for your cattle on the program now. Cattle prices will not be as low as they were in 2023 for at least the next 5 years, probably even longer, according to one industry analyst. Comes as new figures from the ABS say Australia's cattle herd is in a holding pattern, but there is a big difference depending on which state your cattle are in as to exactly how your herd is going. I had a chat to Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends about that data and about how much Australian cattle are getting compared to those around the world.
Very interesting figures, Warwick, in the sense that the herd continues to contract, but the pace of liquidation has slowed down dramatically. And overall, we've still got a number of states, I guess, contracting, but I would at best describe the herd today in a holding pattern across Australia. But interestingly, we had, of the number of states in which was contracting the last quarter, there was close to three contracting, I guess, in the last quarter. And today that's jumped to four contracting, two on hold, two now expanding. So we've got Queensland actually improving and Tasmania improving in terms of rebuilding, but the other states still are contracting, and it nets out with overall Australia's in a holding pattern.
So we're not getting bigger, we're not liquidating. I suppose, does that show that farmers and the industry in general just looking at the weather to see what will happen next?
I think you've really got to look at it state by state, Warwick, and I think it tells me that New South Wales truly was the problematic state, that was the driest. And we saw, you know, in that August, September, October period, the driest 3 months on record. But also it tells us where the rain's fallen. And would you believe that, you know, over the last 3 months, Queensland's rainfall is in their top 10% over the last 120 years. So they've really responded to that November, December, January rain. And interestingly, Victoria sits in the top 2%. We've got one of the second or third highest last 3 months in Victoria of rainfall on record. I think that figure for Victoria really is an overflow of New South Wales cows coming into Victoria to be liquidated. And it's distorted the Victorian figures.
Where does this leave the state of the beef market? We saw difficult conditions for farmers in terms of prices they were getting at the end of last year. That turned around the turn of the year. Where do we sit now?
Well, Warwick, to me, all of this recent rise is on the back of restricted supply. It isn't on the back of strong global markets. So contrary to popular belief that higher exports means better demand, that's not true. In actual fact, throughout all of last year, we took lower prices in all global markets with beef and with lamb and mutton. And we've come off the bottom. That's without doubt in the last probably quarter, but we're still hovering at the bottom and we're needing global markets to improve. So the take-home message, Warwick, is we need global demand to pick up.
I've spoken to you in the past about Australia having the cheapest beef in the world. Is that still the case?
No, it's not. I mean, you know, we can find lots of countries, but right now, in actual fact, we are cheaper than Brazil and the US. Today, Australia sits on finished cattle into the processor of around $390 a kilo live weight. We've got Brazil at $445 for an equivalent size animal, and the US at $6.
That's Australian dollars?
That's correct, Warwick.
So we're not the cheapest, but compared to our major export competitors, we are still cheaper in terms of what farmers are getting for cattle than those nations. Because of that, you see upside in what producers can get this year.
Warwick, I think globally, livestock prices are too cheap, full stop, including America, including Brazil and ourselves. And I'm of the opinion, about to move into resetting the market and what I would call the new norm, in which we are going to trade at significantly higher levels than what we've seen over the last 5 years. And as we get into 2025 next year and beyond, we trade at new levels. And with that, I am calling the EYCI, the ECI, to be at around about 1250 in 2026 and 1250 in 2027. Today's price is about 650. Today, the figures showed us on cattle that we've come out at a break even. We're neither building or liquidating. But as we go forward, I think the peak in production for beef has now been put in place. And hereafter, for the next probably 5 years or longer, 7 years, we will not get back to these high levels of beef production.
Extrapolating that out, you think the low prices of 2023, particularly for beef producers, is probably the worst they're going to get for the next half decade?
For longer. Thereafter, Warwick, I have a seven-year average on pricing on the EYCI from 2025 to 2032 at 1,050. And if we were to talk in feeder steer prices, my seven-year average for 2025 to 32 is 520. Keep in mind today's price is 345 live weight. So a 520 average on feeder steers for 7 years from 2025 to 2032. Welcome to the new norm.
That is Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends, probably, well, giving you good news if you're a beef producer hoping for higher prices over the next decade. I'd say we'll have to follow it along to see if it plays out. Speaking of high prices, how's this? A block of land in southwest Victoria is sold for the eye-watering sum of almost $56,000 a hectare, over $22,000 an acre. The 51-hectare dairy runoff property at Mapunga, east of Warrnambool, I got there, sold at a local dairy farming family. Auctioneer Rob Rickard from Elders Real Estate says it's the highest price he's seen in that district.
I had a good crowd of local people, so talking to one of the locals prior to the auction, it was the first auction he can remember in over 30 years held in the Mapunga West region. So it was a pretty exciting day for the local community, and held on site, a really, really appealing bit of land, just 10 or 15 minutes just out of the regional centre of Warrnambool heading to the east. And, purchased by a local dairy farmer for $22,550 an acre. Pretty big result, or a very big result. And, then they had to buy the water on top of that price, which was another $3,500 a megalitre. So in total, it was a very big result for ourselves and, importantly, for our vendors.
And that figure, Rob, $22,500 plus an acre. I mean, how much of an outlier is that? Is it a record for the district?
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't like sort of going on too much about records, but I can't recall, and I haven't spoken to anybody that's had a sale at that level in the district before, particularly for land that is zoned rural, so there's no upside as far as, opportunity for subdivision. So it's purely rural land going to be used as a dairy out paddock, but it does, it's an exceptional bit of dirt and it does have the opportunity to irrigate. So I suppose there is, the chance that it could be converted at some stage to perhaps another land use, whether it be horticulture or more intensive agriculture. But the people who were successful in buying the property, it will be just used as a traditional young stock, dry cow and fodder sort of conservation block, I would suggest.
So sometimes when we get these out-of-the-box sales, there are some extenuating circumstances attached, maybe a historic property or historic homestead or stud or something like that. But in this case, it's purely about the dirt?
Yeah, purely about the dirt and its location. I think it's as I said, it's only a bit over 10 minutes out of the regional centre of Warrnambool, so I think that's probably adds to the attraction. It is an area that's always very, very tightly contested, and it's highly regarded, and probably surprised me when a local farmer did come up to me and suggest he couldn't remember an auction in the last 30 years in Mapunga, because I think any property I'd be selling at Mapunga, I would auction for that reason. It is regarded as high quality land and it's very tightly held.
That is Rob Rickard from Elders Real Estate. Talking about a block of land sold for $56,000 a hectare. Absolutely eye-watering prices. You're listening to The Country. Extended interview looking at the life of Sir John Crawford shortly on the program. Stay ready for that. Really fascinating history, but also messages for the future. Right now, though, let's get rural news with Emma Field, who's back. Hi, Emma.
G'day, Warwick. As you talked about earlier, the Woolworths CEO, Brad Banducci, has quit and Amanda Bardwell has been promoted to the top job. Earlier this week, ABC's Four Corners aired footage of Mr. Banducci walking out of an interview as the company faces allegations of price gouging and unfair practices with suppliers. At an investor meeting for the release of the company's half-year results today, Woolworths chairman Scott Perkins played tribute to Mr. Banducci, who has been at the helm of the company for 9 years, and indicated his departure was nothing to do with recent price controversies.
It is natural to reflect on what he's achieved, and it is remarkable. The board is thrilled with Amanda's forthcoming appointment. In the middle of last year, we decided to move into a different phase and commence the planning for CEO succession with today's date in mind.
And Woolworths' six-month results saw the company post a $781 million loss due to two major write-downs, but its underlying profits are up, driven by sales and profit margins and gains in online groceries. Food sales rose by more than 5% and profit margins on Australian groceries increased by 0.24 of a percentage point. Price increases in excess of rising costs totaled more than $60 million of extra profits on sales of just under $26 billion from its food sales division. Outgoing CEO Brad Banducci says its prices in its food business actually dropped, led by fruit and vegetable prices.
Importantly for our customers, fruit and veg average prices declined by 6.4% in Q2, which was driven in particular by an improvement in availability, including an increased supply of berries, capsicums and zucchinis.
He also pointed out Woolies retail meat prices were down by 7% for the 6 months to the 31st of December last year. And it's worth noting, from July to October, the Eastern Young Cattle Index slumped 37% before rising into December to be down 17% across the same period.
Meat, red meat that is, was the other major contributor, with prices declining 7.2% in Q2 as beef and livestock prices softened. We have seen the number of supply increases requests reduce significantly compared to prior periods. However, they do still remain above pre-COVID levels.
Let's go to the top end now, where ex-tropical cyclone Lincoln crossed the coast into Western Australia's Kimberley region, delivering plenty of rain. Almost 200 millimetres of rain was recorded at Halls Creek as the system moves further west. And the weather system is forecast to move off the Kimberley coast today, but the Bureau says it could return as a cyclone near the Pilbara later in the week, which has been desperate for rain. But the first port of impact was southeast of Halls Creek, where Maddie Staff oversees Nicholson Station.
Here at Nicholson at the homestead, we've had 127 mils since about 1 p.m. yesterday. And then down south in Gordon Downs, one of our farm bots registered 194 mils in the last 48 hours. So a pretty big drop.
What does that mean for you there at the homestead? What are things looking like at the moment?
Well, the Nicholson is visible from the office, the river. It's come right back up over the road, which it had no flow yesterday. So it's a pretty hefty drop. And, yeah, it's probably sitting at about 3 metres at its deepest point there.
What do you expect that to do over the coming days?
It all will depend on what we get upstream across the border in Bunda and things. So hopefully it drops, but it will normally stay up for about a week or so at about the metre mark.
And finally, could one of the country's most invasive weeds be used as a form of cement? University of South Australia researchers have found enzymes from prickly paddy melon weed could be turned into biocement, which could be used in construction or hardening soils. Paddy melons cost the agricultural industry around $100 million a year, but University South Australia Professor Meezana Rahman says they have been looking for an alternative cementation agent, and paddy melons could be the answer.
As you know, cement is quite not good for environment. They produce 1 kilogram of carbon dioxide for 1 kilogram of cement. Then studies started with the idea of biocementation. So, you know, the sandstone, they form over hundreds of thousands of years. So we want to mimic the technique. I was looking for something more specific. Come to my mind, the paddy melon that produces lots of seeds, and seeds germinate. So then I collect paddy melon through one of my colleagues. He being one bag of paddy melon. Then we tried in the lab, and we're surprised that it ticks all the box. It's actually very active and young there, and they can do very good cementation.
And that's Rural News for this Wednesday.
I think you got a lot of farmers excited, or even the poor land managers excited there with that story. Emma Field, paddy melon cement, if you can turn paddy melons into something that is of great value, that is going to be amazing. Good use for a weed, turning it into cement. There, you can tell us how you feel about that. 0467 842 722. Someone saying, 22,500 an acre. How many acres? Well, it's 51 hectares. You should be able to do those maths. I got Google to do it for me. 126 acres for you playing at home. Christy Johnson is a senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau, though. Let's get straight into the weather forecast, because it's a really interesting day tomorrow. You're going to hear a lot about sort of the weather, what's predicted this afternoon into tomorrow, and how that could affect you with fire weather warnings, etc. Christy can take you through a lot of that right now. Good afternoon, Christy.
Good afternoon, Warwick.
We should start with today. Surprising amount of rain in Shepparton. I don't think we were expecting much, and we ended up with close to 20 mils or maybe even more. Has that rain fallen elsewhere?
Yeah, look, not a lot elsewhere. I mean, yesterday we had some good rainfall totals out in the east, around the East Gippsland Hills particularly, and also, in fact, through some of the eastern suburbs of Melbourne with some thunderstorms. But, yeah, those showers and storms did kick on overnight through the northern country, northeast sort of area, brought some decent rainfall totals, but, you know, nothing sort of reaching severe criteria with those storms overnight. Some of the ones yesterday, it did fall in a shorter period of time, and we did have some warnings out. But since 9 a.m, though, we haven't had a lot. We've only had, Tatura's had 6 millimetres since 9 a.m, so it is sort of easing off now. We could still see some more showers and thunderstorms today. They're not expected to produce too much rainfall, probably mostly just looking at sort of, I guess if you get a thunderstorm, maybe sort of 10 to perhaps 20 millimetres, but for most places, sort of, you know, less than 5 millimetres, I would expect with any shower activity today. It's pretty warm, obviously, as people probably noticed. We're expecting temperatures into the sort of high, lovely to high 30s in the northwest, up around 36, 37 at Mildura, Swan Hill, Horsham. I think we're already up to about 35 at Walpiup. And we're looking at temperatures more into the low 30s elsewhere through the north, and in fact really across most of the rest of the state. So a warm one today, but the winds are not too strong, so that's keeping the fire dangers a little bit under control. We do have high fire danger in the Wimmera and the southwest today, but tomorrow is going to be the big fire weather day. So that's when we're going to see the temperatures spiking up into, the low 40s in the northwest and the mid to high 30s across the rest of the state. And we're going to see the wind strengthening ahead of the change that's going to move through. And then that gusty change and pretty dry air as well. So that's going to give us those extreme fire dangers. Tomorrow we've currently got extreme fire danger forecast for the Wimmera, the southwest and the central district. But the Mallee and the Northern Central, and maybe to some extent the Northern Country, are pretty close to those thresholds for extreme. So we could see maybe one or two of those districts bumping into extreme when we crunch the latest numbers this afternoon. But at the very least, yeah, pretty high fire danger right across the six western and central districts for tomorrow as those winds strengthen. And those hot temperatures get even hotter than today.
And when are the winds likely to sort of move across the state?
So at this stage, the timing of the cool change, it looks like moving into the southwest in the early afternoon and then moving across into central and northwestern districts in the evening. So through Melbourne, not that anyone cares, around between about 6 and 8 p.m., probably similar timing through the sort of the northwest, maybe slightly earlier than that through the fires in the Grampians. But we'll be issuing wind change charts to give our fireys up there the latest information. as it comes to hand as we get the high resolution modelling. But yeah, that's the sort of timing that we're looking at for the cool change, and then it'll move through the east sort of overnight and through Friday morning.
And I suppose then just for the rest of the week beyond that Friday, the weekend and beyond, what's sort of the outlook there?
Well, I guess before we move on, I should mention that there is some risk of thunderstorms with the change. Now, it won't be anything like what we had last Tuesday, but there is the risk of some reasonably gusty winds, particularly with thunderstorms or even without thunderstorms over places like maybe some of the elevated areas or the Otways and the Surf Coast in particular could see some pretty strong winds during the morning, sort of downslope there. So it will be a windy day, and obviously with some trees weakened or branches still sitting in trees from the damage last week, you know, just obviously asking everyone to take care out there. Those thunderstorms aren't expected to produce much in the way of rainfall tomorrow, so it should be a fairly dry day, actually. A lot of the rainfall evaporating before it reaches the ground. But we could also see some lightning causing fire starts as well with the chance of some thunderstorms. So just something else to watch tomorrow. But as the change moves through the east on Friday morning, it does pick up a little bit more moisture. So there is the risk of a little bit more rainfall in the east on Friday morning as that trough goes through, not looking at huge rainfall totals, but you know, there is that potential for some sort of, you know, 10 to 25 millimetres maybe with isolated totals with thunderstorms. Most parts seeing on and south of the ranges, just seeing sort of up to 5 millimetres in some showers following on from that change, and obviously much cooler temperatures, mostly into the low 20s or low to mid 20s across the state, maybe even just 19 at somewhere like Ballarat or Warrnambool for Friday. But then it's pretty settled. So on Saturday, we'll see those showers clearing from the west as the next high pushes through, and the temperatures recovering a little bit. They're still sort of in the low 20s in the south and the high 20s in the north. Sunday warming up a little bit as the high moves across and we get winds sort of a bit more northeasterly or northerly, getting up into the, I guess, the mid-20s in the south and the high 20s or low 30s in the north. Monday, at this stage, looking a little bit cooler. We see a front travel over Tassie. Doesn't really push much in terms of rainfall over us, but just southerly winds that are a bit cooler on Monday, particularly through the south. It's still reasonably warm, high 20s, low 30s in the north, but just low 20s in the south on Monday. And then a warming trend for the middle of next week. So Tuesday, warming up into the high 20s in the south, low 20s or low to mid-20s in the north, maybe even 37 at Mildura. And at this stage, Wednesday looking quite warm as well. Temperatures getting into the 30s across most of the state.
Wednesday's the hot one. Christy, thank you so much for the update. Right. I've got to run to another interview, but really appreciate especially the in-depth outlook for tomorrow.
No problem. Thanks, Warwick.
Christy Johnson, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau, taking you through the full forecast there. We've got markets on the way. I did say we've got a special feature interview before we get there. Let's go into some of that. Now, a city boy turned economist who became one of the great Australian agricultural minds and changed farming around the world is the subject of a new book looking at continuing that legacy. The book is called Buying Time, J.G. Crawford, an International Agricultural Research by Dennis Blight and Nicholas Brown, published by the Crawford Fund. It's being launched today in Canberra at the National Press Club. I had a chat earlier to one of the authors, Professor Nicholas Brown, about Sir John Crawford, his legacy, and how it can be seen in farming and food across the globe.
Crawford is of a generation. He's one of that generation of scholarship boys who get access to higher education in the late 1930s, go to university, eyes are opened, suddenly the world looks like it's facing huge challenges with the Second World War, opportunities arise for kids like Crawford to be drawn into government, and once they get into government, they get fired up by this image of reconstruction, post-war reconstruction. It's hard to imagine how desperate, particularly rural Australia, and Crawford experienced rural Australia in the late 1930s as a cadet teacher in Temora in New South Wales, but how desperate the situation in rural Australia Australia was in the 1930s. And while Crawford, as he said, he was not a farm boy. His father was a station master in Sydney. But for some reason, he was energised by the notion that reforming agriculture, not just for Australian farmers getting access to markets in the world, but you're not going to get access to markets in the world unless people in the rest of the world, particularly Asia, and he was early onto the promise of Asia, have got the resources to buy what we want to sell. So what Crawford starts thinking about under the rubric of kind of post-war reconstruction is, if Australia is essentially an agricultural economy, if that's our strength, if we want to find the money that we can use to invest in secondary industry, the only way we're going to be able to do that is by feeding, as he would put it, kind of ironically, because this is not the language that he used, the starving millions of Asia. He didn't think about them in those terms. He thought this is a market opportunity, but more fundamentally, these are human beings that deserve good food, good nutrition. You feed them, they'll get more prosperous, they'll buy our stuff, we'll get the money, and so the cycle goes on. But what sounds like a really crude economic proposition put in those terms, in the 1950s draws Crawford into a really big vision of international development that is built around agriculture. It's built around popular campaigns like Freedom from Hunger. It's built around the big investment that internet philanthropic organisations like the Ford Foundation and the World Bank are making in agriculture. I think why I'm so excited to talk to you about Crawford is that we need to be reminded, I think, of how powerful farming was and agriculture was as a way of thinking about the world in the 50s and 60s. We now think about the world very much in terms of manufacturing or of industry or of, you know, services and so on. But for somebody of Crawford's generation, the challenge of the world was firstly starvation, secondly nutrition, thirdly getting the security in people's lives that would come from that.
And that's literally kind of a way to change the world, right? Like
literally a way to change the world. How are you, and there's one really, for a while Crawford was Secretary of the Australian Department of Trade, the first department that's set up to really comprehensively develop trade policies with Asia. And he just says to his officers, quite frankly, you're concerned about the Cold War. This is in the late 1950s. Let me tell you, the only way we're ever going to win this Cold War is if people in developing or underdeveloped countries are properly fed. You feed them, they won't see us as a threat. They'll see the world opening up in front of them just as we see the world opening up in front of us. So on the one hand, he's really pragmatic. On the other hand, he's driven by a fairly kind of fundamental conviction that what drives the world to insecurity is inequality.
Let's bring in the concept of this book then too, the concept of buying time from Crawford. And given the period of time that he is working in, we're talking the Green Revolution here, aren't we? The use of synthetic fertilisers, the ability to produce much more food than the generations prior, and what that meant for feeding the world and for hunger around the world. Absolutely. As well. So what is this concept of buying time?
The concept, Crawford, for a range of reasons, partly because as a senior public servant, he was very involved in a lot of international negotiations about, quite frankly, getting Australian farmers better access to markets through the General Agreement and Tariffs and Trade, and won't take you down that path. But Australian agriculture is being systematically excluded from major markets through this period. So Crawford is a pretty aggressive advocate for opening up access to those markets. That brings him to the attention of other organisations, particularly in the United States, who are starting to think also about how can we use agriculture more effectively to address these issues of insecurity. Again, it's the World Bank, it's the Ford Foundation, and so on. At exactly the same time, in a related argument, Norman Borlaug is starting to develop the Green Revolution, the genetic hybrid breeding of higher-yielding grain varieties to address exactly this problem. And Crawford, even though he's an economist, picks up very particularly on this issue. And I would go so far as to say, because he's an Australian, he's very early identified as somebody who could be a kind of a neutral player in taking a technology that was often associated with US interests and introducing it to developing countries, particularly in India initially, but also in Indonesia, later on less successfully in Iran. But the Green Revolution to Crawford offered an opportunity of addressing what he would see as the priority of addressing the insecurity of food. Where buying time comes from is, even in the 50s and 60s, Crawford is saying, this is not the solution. Overpopulation is still out there. Environmental consequences of more intensive farming is still out there. But until we address, as the first issue, the insecurity that comes from malnutrition and hunger, we're not going to get anywhere in talking about those more pressing questions or those longer term questions. So again, it's partly this issue of pragmatism. Crawford embraced the Green Revolution, but he did not necessarily talk about it as the be-all and end-all solution to the world's problems. He said it will buy us time to address those more fundamental questions. And for him, in the 50s and 60s, the more fundamental question was overpopulation. Clearly for us now, you could argue that the more fundamental question is environmental impacts.
Which leads to Crawford's not only the response to the Green Revolution, but to the issues of his day and putting the building blocks in place of organisations that we still use today. His fingerprints, if you will, are on the continued drive in Australian agriculture for improvement, aren't they?
Well, they are, and they are at an international level and at a national level. I mean, as you say, I mean, one of the difficulties of writing about Crawford is that, as you say, his fingerprints are everywhere. And it's interesting to ask why. Why is an Australian economist appointed the first chair of the Technical Advisory Committee that advises the Consultative Group of International Agricultural Research when it's established in the 1960s on how to allocate huge amounts of funding to the research centres that are being set up around the world? Now, I'm sorry for those kind of big names. I mean, this book is jam-packed full of acronyms because really from the 1960s onwards, Crawford is living at the highest level in one part of his life. The other part of his life is, you know, he's Vice Chancellor and Chancellor of the ANU and providing the Hawke government and the Fraser government with the reports and all of that kind of stuff. But one part of his life is being lived overseas as an Australian economist, as a neutral figure, in a sense, buying time in advising major international organisations on what are the priorities for agricultural research.
What countries, what trips overseas do you think had the greatest impact on Crawford's views on agriculture and what research was needed?
He was closest to India for a range of reasons. The first major commission that he had from the World Bank was to be the agricultural specialist to what's often called the Bell Report. So in 1965, the World Bank is kind of sitting back looking at what really, to put it crudely, was the basket case of India. I mean, there are five-year plans coming out of India, but there's really no evidence that they're making a huge amount of difference to the extent that India is still a struggling, underfed country. Also, India is making a number of choices, particularly in terms of war against Pakistan and so on, that the World Bank is not comfortable with, and the United States, which clearly is very closely associated with the World Bank, is not comfortable with. So the Bell Report is an inquiry into how does India need to get this story straight, bluntly, before we go back in and fund them again. And what is significant about the Bell Report in 1965-66 is that it's the first time, in a sense, that the World Bank puts agriculture first. And it puts a form of agricultural intervention, which is not, you know, the World Bank up until this point would invest in infrastructure, big works, that kind of high-level development. But the Bell Report is very much about how do we get at the local level, with the expertise of the Green Revolution, Indian farmers back up and functioning. Because again, until we address that problem and all of the social and political issues that come out of that problem, India is going to be a very difficult problem, difficult issue to deal with. And India is also in this period being identified as the laboratory. So in a sense, the West is saying, if we can get India right, we can use it as a template for elsewhere. If we can't get India right, then, you know, what claims do we really have? But what really is distinctive about Crawford is the extent to which, again, this is not really the World Bank practice up until this point, he develops really close relationships with figures who would become major players in the reform of the Indian economy. One of the major figures was M.S. Swaminathan, who only died very recently, equally as often celebrated as one of the heroes of the Green Revolution. Crawford was not just advising the Indian government, but he was developing close personal relationships with Indian scientists, not necessarily with politicians, but with Indian scientists. That meant that those scientists felt that they could, again, to put it crudely, cut through the politics and start actually applying, as Swaminathan would put it when we spoke to him, in farmers' fields, the expertise that was coming from laboratories in the developed world. And that, I think, is one of the real strengths of Crawford, and one of the things that we kind of noticed over and over again in working on this. Yes, he's a really big figure in the institutions, but where he matters most profoundly, and what we're trying to explore to the extent we can in this book, are in those relationships that he develops, the trust that he develops, the ways in which groups of people who might have an antagonism to feeling as if they're being bossed around by the World Bank or by the United States government feel that in somebody like Crawford, they have an honest broker, or somebody, again, like Crawford, who is able to see what do we need to do now rather than where are we being forced to go in the future. So again, it's that kind of buying time argument. No politician, no scientist, nobody in a developed country wants to be pushed around.
That is Professor Nicholas Brown, who with Dennis Blight has co-authored the book Buying Time, J.G. Crawford, an international agricultural research being launched today. It is an amazing read of Australia's history in terms of its agricultural science and what it has given to various parts of the world, in a lot of ways through one person too, which is quite amazing. Got some interesting texts coming in from many of you. We might not have time for it all. We better get straight into markets though to see if we do. We'll start with the sheep and lamb market reports today, and we'll go to Chris Agnew at Hamilton to kick us off. Take it away, Chris.
Thanks, Warwick. Hamilton agents penned 9,400 lambs, representing a reduction of 4,100 on the previous week. Not all the processors were present, and those that were on the rail were not always fully active. There was also reduced feeder and restocker interest. The market overall was fully firm to $10 per head dearer over some categories, dependent on quality, with the lambs back to the paddock also up by $10 per head. The best of the heavy lambs this week sold to $210, with the majority of the lambs realising between 600 and 680 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Light 12 to 16 kg lambs sold from 50 to 116, with the 18 to 22 trade lambs 115 to 150, with the 22 to 26 kilo lambs making from $136 to $160. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Let's go to Horsham now and Graham Palmer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply increased to 5,100. There was a modest lift in sheep numbers to 1,700 head. Medium and heavy trade weight lambs sold for 135 to 165. Heavyweight sold to 223. Merino lambs mostly ranged from 90 to 130 and averaging 530 to 550 cents. Restockers paid from 129 to 158 for better bred shorn lambs, $20 to $70 for lighter weights and 77 to 110 for unshorn lambs. Sheep quality covered all grades, with sheep selling to stronger competition to be dearer by $10 a head. Merino ewes made to 94, heavy crossbred ewes to 80, Merino weathers to 98. Light trade lambs sold from 126 to 140, averaging 590. Medium trade weight sold 135 to 148, average 600. The medium weight sheep sold from 42 to 84. Merinos averaging 270 cents. The crossbreds 225. Graham Palmer at Horsham for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Graham. Lucky last is Lean Gather Cattle and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. There were 500 more at 2,000, with the usual buyers operating in a dearer market in places. Quality was mixed, with most weights and grades represented. Better quality trade cattle lifted 5 to 10 cents, while secondary lots eased. Bullocks gained 13 cents. Manufacturing steers sold 5 to 15 dearer. Cows sold from firm to 10 cents dearer. Heavy bulls eased slightly. Vealers sold from 280 to 374. Yearling trade steers 296 to 360. The heifer portion 266 to 320. Grown steers steers 290 to 318, bullocks 285 to 326, heavy Frisian manufacturing steers 218 to 265, crossbreds 240 to 305. Most light and medium weight cows 78 to 200 cents, heavyweights 180 to 258, heavy bulls 218 to 268. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thank you very much for that, Brendan. That's about all the time we have for you on the Country Hour today. If you'd like to listen to even an extended version of that discussion around Sir John Crawford, or listen back to yesterday's argy-bargy around the future of the Victorian Farmers Federation and where things stand there, if you have questions or you want to get in contact, well, start by listening to the podcast, the Victorian Country Hour podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Then send us an email, countryhour@abc.net.au. I'll catch you again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. It's 1 o'clock.